Chris Reback. This is Investigating Breast Cancer, the podcast of the Breast Cancer Research Foundation and conversations with the world's leading scientists studying breast cancer prevention, diagnosis, treatment, survivorship, and metastasis. Today's conversation offers an amazing example of the power of research, of what can happen when scientists globally work together and study the challenge of genetics and breast cancer. My guest is Dr. Fergus Couch, who is, among many other roles, professor and chair of the Division of Experimental Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Couch works on the genetics of breast cancer, discovering and understanding the connections of inherited genetic variants in cancer susceptibility genes. He's also a BCRF grantee since 2007. Dr. Couch has more than 300 publications, but the one we focused on came just a few months ago, and it was an incredibly big deal. The outcomes were published in the prestigious publications Nature and Nature Genetics. Dr. Fergus and other scientists reported findings by a major international consortium identifying an incredible 65 previously unknown common genetic variants that predispose individuals to breast cancer. They also found seven others that are specific for triple-negative breast cancer, the highly aggressive form of the disease. In all, that's 72 new genetic variants that contribute to breast cancer risk. The numbers that drove the research are remarkable. Over 500 researchers from 300 institutions in six continents contributed genetic data from some 275,000 women, 146,000 of whom had been diagnosed with breast cancer. What do these new genetic discoveries mean? How might they change how we think about breast cancer? And what actions or decisions might people take? That's what I asked Dr. Couch. Dr. Couch, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
So I see in researching for this, I see that if this breast cancer research thing doesn't work out for you, you clearly have a new career in social media. How did you like that Twitter chat you hosted in November?
I'm not one who does a lot of Twitter, so it was a new adventure for me. But I think it was great. We were able to answer a lot of questions, give a lot of feedback to people who clearly are a little confused about aspects of this stuff. So, I think it's clearly a media function that I think has great possibilities going forward.
But no career
just
change
getting
for
information
you.
Out.
No,
probably
change?
Not. I'm past that point.
Okay, you'll stick with the science. That's probably better for all of us. So let's get to your most recent. I don't know for sure that it's your most recent. With more than 300 publications, I think, to your name, you may have published another 10 pieces since the one in Nature and Nature Genetics. But let's talk about that research because it was obviously an incredibly big deal. What was the OncoArray breast cancer study?
This is a worldwide collaboration consortium. There's probably 150 groups involved from all over the world, and we've been working together for about 10 years. And the whole idea is to use samples from breast cancer patients and use samples from people who are unaffected by breast cancer, do genetic studies in those DNA samples. This is some samples from blood, not from tumors. So do genetic studies on those and then try to come up with a series of genetic factors that we all, many of us inherit, and trying to see if some of those are associated with increased breast cancer risk. And it turns out there's hundreds of them in the human genome, and we all have some of them, maybe not all of them. And you can put them together in combinations to come up with strong risk factors for breast cancer. So this particular study involves really doing enormous numbers of DNA samples. When we combined all the various studies together at the end point, there were over 200,000 breast cancer patients and 200,000 unaffected individuals that we genotyped for many different genetic markers all over the human genome. So the amount of data is just astonishing. It needs, huge server to store it all. But when we did all the analysis, we end up with approximately, the numbers move around a little bit, but approximately 180 genetic risk factors for breast cancer. And what's interesting about these particular risk factors, we've all heard about the BRCA genes, right, which are very high risk factors. If you have a mutation, a rare mutation in the BRCA gene, you're at very high lifetime risk of getting breast cancer.
Yep.
In this case, if you have one of these little guys, it's almost meaningless. you know, the increase over the average general population is only about 10%. That's the equivalent of having an alcoholic, you know, a drink of alcohol every now and again. It's a very, very low risk that we could not ever use clinically. But when we put them together, 180 of these things all stacked up on top of one another, it comes out to be actually a very strong risk factor. And so common risk factors that are out there for breast cancer right now are high breast density, parity, so the number of children that you have, BMI, so body mass index or essentially weight, diabetes, things like this are strong risk factors. And so this would be equivalent to any one of those really particularly strong ones. So what people are doing now with that information is trying to incorporate it into risk models. So what I mean by that is a patient walks in the door of the clinic, they're worried about their risk of breast cancer. There's a number of statistical models that the physicians can run on them to give them some feel for whether they're at high risk or low risk. We can now start to incorporate all these genetic markers into those risk models to better inform and to give more precise estimates for each individual. So in the past, it was like lumping everybody together and everybody looked like they were the same. Now we can sort of itemize it out, so each individual gets their own approximation of risk. So that's one aspect of the study. Yeah.
Yep, go ahead, please.
Well, the other aspect of it is just the biology, understanding how breast cancer happens. So here's 180 new genes that are involved in breast cancer that we didn't know about before. And now we can go off and do all kinds of laboratory-based experiments to figure out how do they contribute to breast cancer, how is breast cancer happening or growing, given all these other factors now that seem to impinge upon it. So the biology community is very excited as well, because they can run off and start understanding the disease better than they did before. But then we've also got the clinical side that I just talked about, where we can do better risk estimation.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the significance and the ways in which, you know, to now be able to start to personalize that risk profile and start to really, you know, understand it and look at that list and what that can mean for individuals and decision making and risk assessment. I imagine. Did as you were going through it, did the permutations just kind of did your, you know, in layman's terms, did your brain just kind of go crazy? I mean, how do you start to process the range of risk factors and the way that they can, you know, work together and pile up, and, you know, using your language, pile up together, and the math involved in that? How did that work for you, just thinking through as you were going through doing that research?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit easier than it might seem.
Well, that's good, because it seems really hard, so I'm glad it's easier.
Well, once you've identified all the factors, then you just have to decide on which statistical approach you're going to use. And in this case, we decided that we would just essentially add the effects of all these things together to see if that would be informative. And then you really just compare against, you have a group of patients who have cancer and you have a group that don't. That's sort of your test set, in a way, your test set of patients. And you just run your selected statistical model of that and see how well it performs. You know, how well did it predict the cancer in these individuals?
Yep.
And so we do these tests, we do validations in other populations. And so the model we came up with is this so-called additive model, where it actually performed the best. You can try a whole range of different statistical models, and you look to see which one performs the best in terms of predicting disease. And this one just came up, it fell out, and we have it now. And there's a number of studies that have been published on small sets of these genetic risk factors. But these new papers are really the ones where we first described such a large number of them, and so that the statistical power, the ability to personalize the risk, because we have so many of them, is just so much more improved. The whole community is going for cancer research right now, is how well can we personalize risk? Because for so many years, it was just everybody had the same risk, everybody got the same therapy. You know, that's been the standard for many years. Now we're able to carve it up with all our increased knowledge of breast cancer. We're able to carve it up and give each person their own risk assessment.
That's a big difference. That's a big change.
Yeah, it is. And I think the other thing I should point out is that as we learn, there was approximately 10 of these new factors that actually increase or predict the risk of estrogen receptor negative breast cancer. So when we look at breast cancer, we tend to divide it into categories, and there's estrogen receptor positive, which is about 75%, and then estrogen receptor negative, the other 25%. And the estrogen receptor negative disease tends to be a little bit more aggressive. A lot of people have heard the term triple negative breast cancer. It falls into that category.
Yeah.
So we don't really have a good idea of how to personalize the risk there. So one of the interesting things about these new papers, these new studies that we've just published, is that we were able to come up with markers that are exclusive to the estrogen receptor negative category. So as we go forward now, we think we can start to come up with these risk models for people, a risk model for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer and a risk factor, a risk model for estrogen receptor negative. So a patient walks in the door, we can give them two different scores, and perhaps for each individual patient, those could be dramatically different. You know, they could flip-flop for the different people. But I think it's all with the goal of improving information for the patient, improving knowledge, and giving them better estimates of what their outcome might be. Yeah. Not so much clinical outcome, but whether they'll develop the disease or not.
Yeah, certainly a much better sense. And, this sense of personalized risk is... That's a major difference. Help me understand. I've just confused myself. So you talked about 180 risk factors. Reading about your research, I also noticed, of course, that part of what you guys discovered was 65 previously unknown common genetic variants that predispose individuals to breast cancer. How does the 65 relate to the 180? And I guess there were then maybe another seven genetic factors that you found as well. So just help me understand, I guess those were the seven others that were specific for triple negative breast cancer.
Yes, exactly.
So help me just understand the 180 versus the 72, let's call
it. So I think as of today, our total number, our cumulative number is 180 of these, we call them SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. It's just a jargon term that we use in genetics. Let's call them risk factors for this conversation. But we have a total of 180 now. As I said, we've been working together as a consortium for 10 years. We've been finding small batches of these things all the way along. So in fact, with some prior studies, we were already up to between 100 and 120. And now with this new huge study where we did 200,000 individuals, we were able to find 65 new ones.
I see.
And that adds on top of the 120 to give 180 approximately.
Gotcha.
The important thing is it really extends our ability, the ability of these statistical models to predict. It really enhances that ability dramatically by adding in these new ones.
So what
and then, of course, tells us all about the biology.
Yeah. So how, I mean, that, exactly. I mean, that's a massive jump from, call it 110-ish to 180.
Yep.
You're raising it by, another 60, 70%. What happened? What was it about the data that you had? Was it the volume, the 200 and, nearly 300,000, women and 146,000, of whom I guess had been diagnosed with breast cancer? Was it the quality of the data? Was it an advancement in the math or the research? How are you just able to, all of a sudden discover another 72 risk factors?
Right. So there are two things went into it. Number one is just the numbers game. We just had many, many more patients. We really doubled or tripled the number of patients that we had been studying previously. So by doing more, you gain in more information, and it helps you to discover. It increases what we call the statistical power of the study. It helps us to find this information that was previously overlooked. The second part of it is that it's more of a technological thing, is that when we look across the genome, we're not actually sequencing the whole genome. We're looking at little, what we call the SNPs, right? We're looking at various SNPs all the way across the genome. And in the past, the best we could do was to look at about 200,000 little SNPs or signposts all spread all over the genome, which didn't really capture all the information within the genome. Now with this new Onca array, we're able to do 535,000. So
wow.
We, again, went 200,000 up to 500,000. So again, we were now looking at little parts of the genome that we had overlooked before. And suddenly, with the extra patients and the ability to look at these extra spots in the genome, we were able to find these additional ones that were looked previously.
And this may be outside of, you know, where you go and your practice. And so, you know, if so, that's fine. You just let me know, of course. So if I'm a person who is worried about risk, maybe I have a family history or any other risk factors, you know, some of which you mentioned before, and I now want to reconsider, you know, my own personalized risk assessment based on what you have found. What should I do? Is this a conversation I should have with my own doctor, or is there anything that I should do? Is it, and again, you know, if I'm extrapolating off what the work that you've done and you're just not at that stage, you'll let me know. But I would imagine that people listening to this will want to know, holy cow, this is incredible. Yep. New amount of data. What do I do?
Yeah, so there's two aspects to that. One is that there's still a lot of research going on in this area to see what the best prediction models might be, which of these risk factors might overlap a little bit so that we get the, you know, make sure we get the right scores out of all this stuff. But with that being said, it is now available clinically. So there's one company, Myriad Genetics. If you order a panel test, and so the panel test is where you're getting tested for genes like BRCA1 and BRCA2, the really high risk genes, they're now offering this panel of common variants that we've been talking about, which, if I can just use another term, we call it the polygenic risk score, or PRS, when we combine all 180 of them together. So if we take that PRS, Myriad Genetics now has their version of the PRS, and they're combining it on the panel with those high-risk genes. And so the idea is that if somebody does not have a mutation, one of the high-risk genes, they still probably have a family history. They probably still are at elevated risk because they have to qualify under insurance for the testing to begin with, right? So it's probably family history positive in some way. Then they give them the PRS score, which gives them some feel for whether they're up or down. And they actually give them the PRS score embedded into a risk prediction model, one of these statistical models I was talking about earlier, so that it's actually clinically useful. It's not just some number out of the air that means nothing to anybody. It's actually in the context of a statistical model that they would normally get in the breast clinic when they go to visit a physician. So if a test is ordered, a blood sample is sent, the testing is done, and then, if nothing else, the PRS score in the statistical model can come back to the physician. The physician is able to interpret that and then can inform or counsel the patient on the basis of what was found. So that's one company who's doing it today, so it's actually available. There's a number of other companies that are developing this right now. So there'll be a range of different products that will be available from people shortly, I would imagine. And then in addition to that, I think a lot of medical centers are actually bringing this up as tests within their own medical centers without having to go to commercial partners. So, for instance, we're doing a number of studies here at the Mayo Clinic where we're actually evaluating it first. We don't want to jump right into our patient population. We want to evaluate it in a small research study first to make sure it works well in the setting of our patients, and then when we know that that's the case, we'll then take it forward as an actual test that our patients can ask for. I think many other medical centers are doing something similar. So there is one product out there. There'll be many more coming soon. You know, so patients can sort of decide what they want for their own purposes. That's in the setting of the high-risk patient, the patient who is qualifying for BRCA1 and BRCA2 testing. This is also potentially quite useful in the setting of someone who does not have a family history. And so that's another study we're doing at Mayo Clinic, and a number of other hospitals around the country are doing this as well. A woman walks in the door. Maybe she's had a lump in her breast, and it was tested, and it's negative, so she doesn't have cancer. But she's worried, and she wants to know, am I at high risk? Should I be getting screening? Should I be getting more mammograms or MRIs, or can I relax a little bit about it? What does the future hold for me? So this is where people are trying to test out this PRS in that setting as well. Could we take that relatively average woman coming into the breast clinic who right now does not have a breast cancer diagnosis and say to her, yes, based on your PRS, we would put you in a higher risk category, so you should have more screening done. Or we could put you, actually downstage you into a lower risk category, and you can relax a little bit and you only have to come back maybe every 2 years for follow-up care or something like that. So there's a lot of work being done in that area as well. So if you think about it, it can apply to two different types of patients. One is the very high risk patient with the family history, and the other is your regular patient walking in the door who's just a little bit worried about breast cancer and maybe has had a biopsy or something like that that was negative.
I mean, it's really a new evolution in terms of the ability to assess risk is what it sounds like to me. I mean, you know, that second group that you just referred to, I mean, both groups, obviously, but both of them, I mean, they both kind of, it blows me away. But, you know, yes, the first question any of us as patients get for anything, not, you know, almost any kind of hereditary disease or diseases that could have a hereditary component to them, you know, we're asked about family history, you know, heart disease, you know, all of those things. And that's always among the primary questions. And the ability to, you know, use this PRS and use this scoring to not only, you know, bring a finer point on that inherited sense, but also maybe you don't have that family history, but, you know, there may be reasons why, you know, further screening or deeper screening is useful. And I guess, is it fair to say that previously, you know, historically, that just might have been missed because, you know, this type of scoring wasn't available? Is that fair? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it is fair to say that. We did have these other risk models where we would look at the family history, we would look at the number of biopsies the patient had, we would look at their risk factors like breast density, BMI, as I mentioned before, so the body mass index, things like that. We would factor all those into standard risk models. And those were actually relatively useful. They could put people into higher and lower risk categories. What the PRS does is improve that. It makes it substantially better. And really, again, personalize the risk for the women better and hopefully do a better job of putting people into higher, moderate, or lower risk categories as well. So we've done a small study here. It's not published yet with Dr. Pruthi here at the Mayo Clinic. And she was running it as a research study and then showing the results to the patient. Here's the results if you just use your standard risk model that we've had before. Here's the results with that standard risk model with the PRS added on. And the patient can then see the difference, right? They can see whether it bumps up or bumps down, and they get to appreciate what's actually driving that. And she's had tremendous response from the patients on that. They really appreciate the ability of this PRS to add to the possibilities of giving them more accurate risks. And again, in the end, we all have to remember it's just a prediction of risk, right? It's not a certainty. But it's useful. It just, again, gives more information to the patient and the physician in terms of determining the management of that patient.
This has to be, and I don't mean to, you know, make you uncomfortable, extremely satisfying. I mean, for somebody, I'm just, you know, thinking about it, and I don't know all of your personal history, and actually I want to ask you about how you got into this in a moment, but for someone who's dedicating his life or her life to this endeavor, to make this type of advancement, it has to be extremely satisfying, I would imagine.
It is. It's tremendous to be able to take something back to the patient. So many research studies that we do, you know, they take 20 years to get to the patient, or they maybe never get to the patient because there's what we find is not important enough clinically. This has been tremendous in that it very rapidly has advanced to the point where we can take it to the patient and help women to decide what their levels of risk are and how to manage their care going forward. So, yeah, that's wonderful. And you know, many of the researchers, again, I'm only one of a very large group of people who are involved in this. And, you know, these people care deeply about the patients who are affected by this disease. And to be able to make a contribution like this is really important.
So how did you get into this? And by this, I mean, you know, going way back into science and research. Was that, you know, I guess we've established at the top that social media was not perhaps going to be your calling, but just judging from your accent, you may not have grown up in Minnesota, though that's where you find yourself now. How did you get into science? How did you get into research?
I'm from Ireland originally, and I went to college in Ireland and got very interested in genetics, human genetics, and came over to Madison, Wisconsin, actually, as part of my PhD in human genetics, and went to a meeting and bumped into Francis Collins, who's the current director of the National Institutes of Health. And was just talking to Francis at a meeting, discussing human genetics, just trying to learn from him because he was a major figure at the time running a genome center, and inquired about training possibilities with him. And he said, okay, come join my team. Oh, by the way, we're doing this slightly unusual project. We think there might be genetics involved in breast cancer, but there's really not a lot of evidence for it. Mary Claire King, and that's a name that we all know in this community, she was the one who first described that there was a gene that might be driving breast cancer. So she had just published her paper in Science on that. And then the community was responding saying, okay, we know that there is a gene somewhere in the genome. Now we have to go find it. And that was the project that Frances invited me to join. And somewhat fortuitous, right? It's turned out to be a tremendous benefit to many patients that many years later, 4 or 5 years later, the BRCA1 gene was found, and then a year later, the BRCA2 gene was found, and subsequent to that, we found many others that increased risk of breast cancer. So just got in it from a very young age in my training process, working with tremendous people, like real visionaries and leaders in the field, and I've just stayed with it for the last 20 years. And to be honest, that this group, this collaborative group that have been involved in this Oncoray paper, many of those people have been in it over the same period of time. So to this tremendous community of researchers who've known each other for 20 years and collaborated for 20 years on many projects. And it's just been a wonderful experience over a long period of time.
That's really something. Were your parents scientists?
Nope, not at all. They don't know anything about science. So. Nope, they were just, small town Ireland, just doing their thing. And the first person to go to college for my family and all that. So,
wow. So you really disappointed them?
Yeah, exactly. I'm the black sheep. I'm the one who ran off to the United States and never came back. That's exactly right.
Well, I hope they forgive you. And you know what? Tough luck for them. It's our gain, obviously.
No, they get tremendous enjoyment out of seeing all the discoveries that are being made.
I'm sure
they appreciate that as well.
I'm sure. And just to close out, BCRF, and I know that there are a number of organizations that really play a role in advancing and helping advance the research. Talk to me, what role have they played in your research and the work that you've done?
Yeah, the BCRF is just a phenomenal organization. They work so hard to raise money, and so much of that money goes into the actual research to fund researchers to do high risk research that will really advance the field. I've been involved with them for about 8 or 10 years. They've funded a lot of my research. They really funded a lot of the research that we're talking about here, the Oncoray work, and prior to that, some of the other genetic studies. So really, they've been right in the middle of all of this, supporting this work, and where a lot of other, I think, organizations were more focused on therapeutics and only therapeutics, which obviously is very important as well. I think BCRF had the vision to actually spread their vision, if you will, and consider all aspects of breast cancer, including risk and risk prediction. Because of the realization that it could be beneficial to patients. So I'm just so thankful for their support. They've really done amazing work, and hopefully that will continue.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Dr. Couch. Thank you for your time and for the work that you've done and that the others have done. It's obviously making a massive difference in everyday lives, and I know that must feel good, and that's a great payoff, and we thank you for all of that. And thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Fergus Couch. My thanks to Dr. Couch for joining and you for listening. To learn more about breast cancer research or to subscribe to our podcast, go to bcrfcure.org/podcasts.